Good morning. Finding a candidate who reflects your values just got a little easier. Today we'll talk with Kona Hawaii's O'olagon about a new online game to make the match. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Affordable housing is a perennial issue. For Mary Murtaugh, it's a perennial business. Her nonprofit has built affordable units since the late 1980s in Hawaii. This morning, we'll talk about how Hawaii can get more of them. On Thursday, October 23rd, it's The Conversation.
And it may be a little late to start planning your costume, but with a little creativity, you can still make it to this weekend's Chinatown Street Party. We'll get a preview of the annual Hullabaloo Music and Arts Festival from organizer Mark Tyrone. And how longtime Maui resident W.S. Merwin, former U.S. Poet Laureate, has spent decades regenerating a palm forest on Maui's North Shore.
Those conversations and a lot more right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We're always asking ourselves at election time what criteria people actually use to make their choices.
And how they feel about those candidates sometimes can be at odds with what answers they actually get from them. And sometimes the bias can pull you in one direction or another.
Right.
But, you know, maybe you feel this way too, that sorting through all the information on a candidate isn't much fun, but now choosing who gets your vote just got a little easier and perhaps a little more enjoyable. Kona Hawaii has launched the Candidate Game. Key Races lets you answer or see answers from the candidates on several issues-based questions. And then without knowing which candidate has answered, you can choose which answer you like. And after you finish the game, well, it matches you with the candidate. Kona Hawaii Executive Director Olin Lagan is here with more details about how the game was developed and how we can all play it to the benefit of our own knowledge and information. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Beth Ann.
You have a lot of races on here. I mean, there are some that are absent. What was your criteria for choosing which races to use?
We only had races where you could play the game where we had more than two candidates responding to the questions. And so when there was a race with two candidates and only one candidate responded, you can still see what the candidate responded, but you couldn't play the game.
For people who say, well, you know, voting shouldn't be a game and it's a very serious business making a choice. Well, all that's true, but your point in making it a game seems to be to remove the bias, to move that emotional tug.
Right. And we also walked in 2012, we knocked about 5,000 doors and just talked to folks like what they felt about the elections. We learned a lot. You know, people found the information out there really boring and hard to wade through. So the game made it a little more fun and gamified it a little bit. We also found that people had no clue about the local elections, their local House, local Senate. The most unknown was the OHA candidates. You know, people would vote and be frustrated, like, who are these guys? And I would like to get more information about that. And so we ended up putting all this information together in the candidate game.
And for a lot of people, too, I'm sure you found that they are looking at information that comes to them in 30 seconds on a postcard, very incomplete. Really doesn't give you a chance to have a specific question about a specific issue that may interest you find an answer.
Right. So we did ask specific questions. We limited the number of words they could use to respond. So it didn't take long to get someone's stance on a specific issue. And we think it's about 15 minutes to get through one race with the game.
Well, we had some of the staffers play yesterday, and I came back a little later, and they were still working at it because it was so intriguing. When you asked them to respond, how many words did you give them to really get to the nut and heart and soul of what they believed? I mean, I'm not down to the actual word, but I mean, they didn't get pages. They got one paragraph.
Right, like a couple hundred words, roughly.
And then you chose the issues?
We did, yes. And we worked with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs candidates as well, too, so we got some Hawaiian-specific questions in there as well.
Were people able to really make a firm discussion in that paragraph? Did you really feel that when you looked at those answers that you could see, you can fairly clearly understand what their stance is?
I feel from our reading of it, it was very fair. And for the most part, most candidates could be succinct within the number of, words that we gave them. And so it was a fair amount of words to answer a specific question.
But there wasn't a lot of obfuscation in there and sort of dodging or dancing?
There were some, yeah, of course. And there were some like one-word answers as well, too. So you got the range there. But then, you know, different people related to different kinds of responses. One thing we get time and time again, people are shocked. They take the game and they play the game and they're like, wow, the candidate I had not heard of or I would never consider voting won most of my responses. And so that says something. You know, we actually have a sitting lawmaker, I will not name that person, who played the game and said, wow, I can't vote for my candidate's, my party's candidate, because I didn't realize the way that this person felt about certain issues that are really dear to my heart.
Changing sort of how we approach candidates, and not just with party affiliation being the really big pull, seems to be part of what you're doing with this, really getting people to look at issues and take a good hard look about how they feel about those issues.
Right. And it forces you to think about them as well, too, not just the candidate, but how you feel about a specific issue. So the game also is designed to get you thinking about these issues, too, not just how I feel about someone else and how they feel about that issue.
Right. But really making you challenge yourself.
Right. Yeah.
As you're now seeing the game being played a lot, do you have a sense that it's ramping up?
Last year, we had about 25,000 people play it. And so far this year, I checked the stats yesterday, it's well over 60,000 page views and growing. So I think this year we're getting a little bit more traction. And so hopefully each year will continue to grow.
And later, are you going to be able to do any sort of, going back and speaking to some of the people who, I mean, obviously you can't track who plays the game, but finding out whether this had an impact. How do you measure that?
We get comments from folks. We get emails. We get social media tweets and on Facebook, people saying, wow, I am now ready to vote based on the game. And so we have enough of that data points to know that, you know, it does make a difference and people are voting as a result of the game. But we do not track who specifically played the game and what their results were.
When you talk about voting readiness, what does that mean when you talk to some of these people and they give you these comments? What is it?
You know, one interesting thing is in 2012, we knocked on 5,000 doors. We registered about 3,000 people. And we got feedback after the elections from folks. Some people were not happy that they were told to vote because then they didn't feel ready. So, for example, the constitutional amendments, they felt like we got them prepped for the candidates but not the amendments. Or the OHA candidates, like, you know, you didn't get us prepped for that. So it felt icky for some folks to not be voting with enough information. And so we feel like we want to continue to expand the game to include these other additions as well. So we'll add constitutional amendments, other races as well.
Because the constitutional amendment questions are pretty weighty this year. One or two of them in particular. But mm-hmm. As people are trying to find out information about that, have you been able to point them in directions where they can get some good, succinct information?
We have not figured that out yet for this cycle. So we've stayed
out of
it.
So you're on your own for the candidates.
You're on your own, unfortunately. So you're not going to get ready for that with our game, but we'll get you ready with the candidates.
Well, this is, and to be fair, something that's been in development. You only used it one cycle back, right?
Right, one cycle back, and it's really a small group of folks doing this. When you think about it, a small group of folks working part-time on this project can educate thousands of people at scale in an unbiased way. So I think that makes me feel good that maybe this is the future, too, that we can cut through some of the money in politics and get people real information that's handy. You know, one thing we did in the game that's interesting is that there's no other service in Hawaii where you can put in your address and get all your candidates on one page. Like, these are your candidates on one page, and you can click through to get their responses, play the game, and so forth. Like, that kind of service makes it easy and accessible for folks, but it doesn't exist outside of the site that we've developed.
Which is to say that now in a lot of races, there's no excuse for not having a whole lot of information and getting out to vote. That's always been the problem, voter turnout. Even with all of the hullabaloo surrounding the primary, you still saw a relatively low voter turnout.
Right.
Are we sort of barking up the wrong tree with this idea of voter turnout as opposed to just focusing on really good knowledge?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer. I'm not an expert in that. And so all I know is that we try to get people to turn out by giving them good information, and there's a correlation there. So like in 2012, we worked at the Office of Elections, and we gave them the address of all the people that we registered. We had tagging, and about 92% of the people we registered actually voted. And I think the reason that they vote is that we cared enough to go a couple of times to their door, ask them, you know, what they felt, and we weren't trying to sell them anything or try to encourage them to vote one particular way.
Right. That was really the heart and soul of that
right.
question, is really getting them to understand that they cared about something.
Right.
And if you care about something, then it's willing, you know, that you're usually willing to give it some of your attention.
We did more listening than talking. So.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see how this plays out. Meanwhile, it's a lot of good fun.
It is. Hopefully, go to kanuhawaii.org. You can even go on your mobile phone and play the game. It takes
and
you 15 minutes.
We'll put a link on it on our Facebook page, too. Thanks, Olin, for coming.
Thank you, guys.
Olin Lagan is the executive director of Kana Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and later in the show, counting down to a weekend hullabaloo. But first, your quiz.
Our islands have appeared in dozens of films and TV shows, and Hawaii continues to be an exotic place to shoot. Off the top of your head, there's probably a good chance you can name at least 10 movies with a Hawaii credit. But today, we're moving away from feature films to focus on reality TV shows, one in particular. In 2006, MTV shot two shows on Maui, both of which were modeled after MTV's successful reality shows Laguna Beach and The Hills. One of those shows was located in Ka'anapali. Despite its success in ratings, it faced heavy criticism and a strong negative response from local residents. The outcry ultimately brought the show's cancellation, and today we'd like you to name that show. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're stumped. Stick around. We'll have the answer for you in the next half hour.
Hi, good morning. I'm Hong Jiang from NTD Chinese Language TV Station. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
It's part Mardi Gras, part Halloween, but seven seasons along, maybe the Hullabaloo Music and Arts Festival has earned a place of its own in the party calendar. It takes a special kind of energy to put together an outdoor event with a dozen and more things going on at once, coordinating local and national performers, praying for good weather. The job is not for the faint of heart, but Mark Tirone has managed to do it year after year. He's in the final stages of getting ready for Saturday's free outdoor extravaganza, and he's with us in our studio today. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for that wonderful introduction, and thanks for having me.
I'm always impressed when I see you that you're not, you know, a complete nervous wreck.
It's the outer shell, as you know, you learn to put on the good face. It is a challenge, but it's something I absolutely love. So I feel lucky to be able to do it.
I have to wonder about, just with outdoor shows, always weather.
Sure, and October is a tricky one for Hawaii,
yeah.
You know, and it's something that definitely gets you a little concerned here and there. But we've one of the great things about Hawaii is there aren't too many terrible nights of weather,
right.
You know,
right.
And some are a little better than others, but it's always pretty, you know. pretty good. But we've gone through it all. You know, 2 years ago, we had the tsunami. It was the night of hullabaloo.
Uh-huh.
So we had to evacuate at peak hour, you know, 8:05, I got the orders, evacuate. And we did, and we got everyone off site within about 30 minutes. We had, you know, close to 10,000 people out in their cars and out of Chinatown. But so you roll with the punches. That's part of the game, and it's part, you know, helps make it a little exciting.
Well, I would also think that surviving something like that would give you a lot of confidence going forward. How much worse can it get, right?
For sure, absolutely. And survival for on the business side of, you know, I've been producing events in Hawaii since 1999, and the perspective and the what I see through those years is survival is a big part of the business. You know, I don't have the festival to be successful. It's not like an IPO release where you need to have this massive thing at the beginning. And,
right.
It's the festivals that, you know, remain part of the community for years and years. The brand grows, you know, more and more people get to see, you know, the great aspects of those events. And you just get a stronger fan base, stronger support base from the people that come down to the festival, from the businesses that sponsor the event. So yeah, survival is a big part of our game.
But I would think that would be part of a kind of sustaining philosophy, thinking long term. Yeah,
exactly, and that's from the get go. You know, our goals are the same as they were at the outset. Which the number one goal is promoting Chinatown, showing what an amazing district it is with the entertainment offerings, with you know, the eateries. You know, it's become one of the best the food centers in Hawaii. Even just the last year, there's been some great additions and some new ones that are announced that aren't on the street yet but are coming soon.
Really does seem to grow year after year. The whole thing of what's happening in downtown does seem to alter a lot.
For sure.
Year in, year out.
And I'd say, this is, again, the seventh hullabaloo, as you mentioned, and Chinatown's in a wonderful place. It's we had the 2008 hit Chinatown pretty – hit everybody hard, but I think it hit Chinatown harder than some other places. And there was a bit of a dip there, and we did lose a few of our initial kind of arts-based businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But we kept a lot of – you know, a number of very strong ones, and now we've added – and I just we're really at a point where it's about to take a big jump forward. So that's – it's a great – you know, I work right there. My office is at the Arts at Mark's Garage. So Chinatown, you know, I do Mardi Gras and hullabaloo.
Right.
Big part of my life, and it's an exciting period right now. The new restaurants, there's just – everything's there for it to take another big step forward.
You know, I definitely see a Mardi Gras influence even in this event. In the music that you choose.
Sure.
Because it's very much outdoor party music, right? Very celebratory.
It fits right in, exactly. So Halloween's such an energetic night, and that's you know, one of the biggest assets of the festival are Chinatown, number one, and number two, Hawaii Halloween passion. And there's nothing, you know, I've been a huge fan of Halloween since a kid through college. You know, always it's been pretty much my favorite night of the year, and I make it a big deal. And I've never seen anywhere that outdoes Hawaii for spirit, you know, the creativity and the costumes. And there's so much aloha on that night. You know, it's a night where Hawaii's generally above average as far as openness to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But on Halloween night, it's like times 10 because there are no norms. Everyone's got literally a different face on and the guard comes down. And it's
right.
A great opportunity to meet other people and just have this this great communal vibe. And that's what Hawaii has naturally on Halloween. So we create that foundation for that to shine is one of the goals.
I think Hawaii Halloween might be a little different from Halloween in other places, because I've seen Halloweens in other cities where you wish the guard hadn't come down quite so much.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I want these people to have more inhibitions than they have at the
sometimes
moment.
Sometimes Waikiki, I think, has gone that level, and we're much
you know what I'm
much
saying, right?
Entity. Yeah, and that's our focus is we get that message across of aloha and communal spirit with our programming. Like we don't never promoted the festival as a giant party because it's absolutely lots of energy and everything. But it's mostly interesting and fun. And we get a diverse crowd. You know, we do a survey, Chris, every year. And last year, one out of every three people was 35 years old or older, which for this type of event in Hawaii, I don't know if that's really been done before, to have a street festival that draws, you know, that kind of diverse crowd. And we had 8 out of 10 people had a 2-year degree or higher. So, you know, it's a lot of professionals coming down. And it's from the outset. The focus on programming. You know, Chris, you were our publicist the very first year.
And right. Yeah, I'd forgotten,
you know,
about that.
When I walked in, I was like, you know, I forgot to mention that to Chris. I wonder if he remembered. You know, we had Maceo Parker the first year and Brett Denon, amazing singer-songwriter, Big Chief Monk Boudreau from New Orleans. So from the outset, you know, really focused on the programming and to make it something interesting, not just a party, just interesting and creative. And
well, it's also, you go to this and maybe hear an artist that you didn't know about. I mean, David Lindley, while well-known to guitar players, is not a household word. He's a great artist. You know, people who have never heard of him are going to love him, right?
And that's the point, right? David Lindley, one of the greatest stringed instrument players in the world, and you know, you're a talented guitar player yourself, and you know guitar so well, and so it's great to hear that you're a big fan, and you know, not a surprise, but yeah, anyone can come down. You know, it's David plays at 6:30 right there. We've got a beautiful stage we bring in, put at the intersection of Hotel and Smith Street, so it's right there at Lucky Belly. And, you know, David's bringing a wealth of instruments. He's going to have it's an oud and a bazooki, and he plays Hawaiian lap steel.
If it's got strings, this guy can play.
Yeah, if it's got strings. And, you know, he plays the blues. He plays, you know, this Middle Eastern styles.
Yeah.
So that's it's been a privilege to feature a diverse range of music and expose people to some beautiful art.
Well, you seem to have a philosophy that if people don't like what's going on one stage, they can go to another, right?
Yeah, thank you. You've really nailed it, Chris, and that was great with that introduction, which you said exactly. So, you know, the range of the festival, David Lindley, later on that stage, we've got a great bounce artist from New Orleans named Big Frida, and if you couldn't have more polar opposites.
But, I just saw a video, I couldn't quite believe it.
I talked to David's tour manager, and they got a kick out of seeing the lineup themselves, actually. They're like, wow, we hadn't heard of Big Frida, but it's diverse. And so, and that's exactly, we have four stages in the street, and if you love singer-songwriters, you can have a singer-songwriter the whole time. We start off with Steph Music. She's a local artist. She's booked at the Grammys this year. So she's part of the official program for the Grammy Music Awards in Los Angeles.
We better run, Mark, but have a great time this weekend.
Thank you very much.
Mark Tirone is coordinator of this Saturday's Hullabaloo Music and Arts Festival. It's free. It starts at 5 p.m. It has four outdoor stages, and it's in Honolulu's downtown arts district on Nu'uanu. Details are at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Fighting money with money.
Anyone with money can come in and literally buy a stake in the democratic process. That's just doesn't feel right in terms of people's understanding of how the system should work.
Tightly targeting campaign money to beat the billionaires to the bullseye. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
It was just an oversight. That was the reason Pacific Resource Partnership gave the Campaign Spending Commission yesterday about its failure to include certain expenditures in its filing to the commission. The unreported expenses surfaced in a collection of 500 emails used during the defamation lawsuit brought by former Governor Cayetano and settled in June. But the Campaign Spending Commission complaint goes on. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check, why it's not done yet. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So that sort of puts everybody in the picture. We've been sort of talking about this, you and I, over the last several months. But yesterday during the meeting, why was it that this wasn't put down and done right then?
There's disagreements going forward. The executive director and the counsel, the attorney basically for the commission, essentially wanted to wait a little bit. They don't know whether it rises to the serious level because, as you say, PRP has apologized, said it was an oversight. They even paid a fine. But it's the commission's chair. that says, well, wait a minute, there seems to be a pattern here. There sure have been a lot of oversights. And I can tell you that Civil Beat's been reporting on PRP since its inception, certainly back to the 2012 race. He's wondering if this actually rises to the level of a felony, and therefore should we send this over to the prosecutor's office? So there is a disagreement, a pretty big disagreement, of how serious the PRP violations are.
In that huge disagreement of, is there a way of between now and November that you really think that they're going to get more information about what whether there's a pattern or not? I mean, there have been two instances that were shown yesterday, but does that a pattern make?
That's a good question, and we certainly will want to find out what they come up with in November. They have definitely been paying close attention to news reports. You mentioned the emails and so forth. PRP's feeling is, look, we've made some mistakes, but this is really not a pattern. They acknowledge the mistakes, they pay the fine, and they go forward. But whether it's a pattern, that's a very difficult thing to prove. I mean, we're talking big money here. Remember when we reported how PRP gave money to Andy Weiner and Jim McCoy and Barbara Tanabe and others?
And you're talking big money there, not just a few thousand dollars.
Six figures. And somehow they failed to report that on their expenditure report to the commission, which, you know, is really something very wrong. By the way, there were two other complaints against PRP that were dismissed yesterday. I should bring those up. They came from a Maui resident, Karen Chun. And another complaint is being settled as well regarding $86,000 that they didn't report on flyers on behalf of Kirk Caldwell 2 years ago.
So at this point, everything stops until the November meeting in terms of any more evidence. I mean, they have what they have, and they're going to have to look at it and see whether it really warrants going off to possible criminal charges.
We'll be there. We'll be following it, Beth, and I promise you.
I know you will, and we'll talk about it
then. There'll be no oversight on our part.
Thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for civilbeat.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and we'll get a chance to hear from Mufi Hanneman today.
Well, yeah, the man who seems to be able to say anything because of where he is in the polls and how he's shaping some of the conversation, being able to push the other candidates. We've been watching that in some of the debates. But tonight, really opening up the conversation and including your phone calls. If you have a specific question for Mufi, we'll take those and talk about the shape of this race and what he thinks. I mean, surely he's in it to win it, but whether or not that's possible given the poll that we just recently saw that pegs him at 12%, well, that's a whole other issue. But certainly being able to push it and shape it is something he can do very well.
Well, and he obviously brings to the table a formidable amount of experience and a great deal of presentation skills, so... You know, no matter what the polls say, this is a formidable candidate.
And we hope it's going to be a very good conversation tonight. Last week we talked with David Ige, and that conversation is archived on the HPR2 website. And you look under Town Square, you'll find it. Next week we're going to talk with Duke Iona, and this Friday we'll be speaking with Jeff Davis. So there will be some ways in which to compare them based on what they tell us on the program and what we hear from listeners.
And this is a pretty, this is an unscripted way to get to know candidates as well. That's one of the real virtues of this kind of format, yeah?
Well, it is a conversation. We have the length of time to be able to have one.
That's right.
And no, we don't script any of the questions. We don't give them to them in advance. We have a conversation, and we see what happens with it. And that, in part, tells you something about a candidate, too.
And it's a conversation in which the public can take part.
Well, that's the most important thing, is being able to have access, because most of what we see is one-directional.
Yeah.
And we're really committed to the idea that you should be able to interact directly with a candidate, and other people can participate in that conversation, too. So tonight, we hope you'll join us at 5 o'clock right here for Town Square and a conversation with Mufi Hanneman.
Now's your chance.
we've asked this question, what's really affordable? Mary Murtaugh has been asking that question for quite a while, at least since the late 80s. Her nonprofit, EAH, has built affordable rentals in California and Hawaii, and this week, a small new development of workforce affordable housing will open. The units are geared to households earning at or below 60% of the area median income. Mary Murtaugh is in Hawaii this week and joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks. Just I'm going to ask you to pull that a little closer to you so we can actually hear you.
How about that?
Much better. Thank you. This word affordable seems to be kind of amorphous. It means one thing to one person, another thing to someone else, depending upon whether you're talking about trying to buy a home or renting a home. And with what you do with EAH, we're talking strictly rentals.
Strictly rentals.
And we're talking for low-income and very low-income people.
That's right.
So what kind of money are we talking about?
We target our housing to households with family income of about $50,000 a year. And that could include two people who are working in the food service industry, or one person who's, for instance, an assistant physical therapist, or a chef, or someone in that range.
I mean, these are people who are good, respectable people with good, respectable jobs.
Oh, yes. Everyone in our properties who is either, unless they're disabled or retired, everyone is working. And there's a huge, huge need for this in Hawaii that's been building for many, many years. I think the statistic is 18,000 units currently needed in the range of under 80% of median.
And you're seeing that even with the property that's going to open in Eva Beach, given those who are queuing up to be able to have one of those, 75 units, and you've got, 800
yes,
people?
Yes, 76 units. We have 800 families, so that's really 1,600 to 2,000 people in line for just those 76 units.
So with 800 families, Mary, I mean, how do you winnow that down to just the 76 units that you have available?
Regrettably, many people don't qualify because of poor credit. They're so strapped with their budgets that often they'll miss payments on electrical bills or something of that nature, and consequently their credit isn't good. So we do work with people ahead of time to help them improve their credit because it makes it much easier for them. And then sometimes we'll resort to a lottery or just do first come, first serve. It's painful. The staff really have to cope with a lot of people who are very, very disappointed.
Because that turnaway factor is huge.
It's huge. But on the other hand, you get the joy of seeing people's faces when they move in, and there's nothing like it.
Meanwhile, we have this huge need, and you talked about that a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at what kind of incentives there are for companies to come in and do it. I mean, you're a nonprofit. It's a different ball game for you in some ways.
Yes.
But what else do you see that we aren't doing well enough? Because you have a long history in Hawaii. It's not as if you're just coming in as a Johnny-come-lately and looking around saying, gee, how do we do something here in the current environment? You've seen this environment develop.
Mm-hmm. We have. Yes. It's really, I think that there's currently the mayor of Honolulu has produced an island-wide housing strategy that's a very commendable first start on a policy to help address this issue. It's very aggressive. They're talking about trying to create 8,000 units per year. I don't know if that's possible given the complexity of the financing and the permitting process and how long it takes to create housing. But definitely that would be wonderful if that could be accomplished. But realistically, we don't know if that's over-aggressive or not. But it's key to try to address this need because the aggregate need is 24,000 units. And homelessness is on everyone's mind as well as affordable housing. But that really is just the tip of this huge iceberg that's been building for many, many years. And people who are underhoused, living in overcrowded conditions, paying vastly more than they can afford for rent, and working two and three jobs just trying to make the rent, is really the vast majority of the population that need this housing.
I mean, that's the normal for situation for most people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And think what a statement it is to say that that's normal for most people.
Which is to say that we don't seem to be addressing the vast majority of those who have these needs.
Right. So I think that the city could provide very, very strong incentives for for-profit developers to provide a percentage of units in the buildings that they build, most of which currently now are targeted to people who are earning lots of money in the, you know, $150,000, $130,000 range, who can easily afford to pay rent and purchase a condominium, but target it instead at people who are under 75,000 or the 50,000 that we target income range. Incentivize the developers to do that and to keep that that housing affordable as long as is possible. And I think it's possible because the city has such enormous power in approving developments that with a well-crafted policy, they could get this done.
Well, we always hear that there's a certain percent set away for as affordable housing, but it's that affordability factor and how that's pitched in that particular area. If you're talking about, you know, in East Honolulu or downtown Honolulu, that starts to be pretty pricey.
Yes, it does. Very pricey. For instance, there's an affordable tower right next to Kukui Tower, which EAH saved from being converted to market rate 18 years ago. Our rents are at Kukui Tower we're at $600 roughly a month, and the tower next door is at $1,600, just to give you an example of what the difference is in rental cost. So as a nonprofit, our goal is to keep the rents low and to keep it permanently affordable. And that's another issue that really needs to be looked at. If we have limited resources, we don't have endless money, endless opportunity. Or endless land. So every piece of affordable housing that you create, you have to preserve for as long as you can possibly do it. Our goal, of course, is to do that. A for-profit goal would not be to do that, but the city could help incentivize for-profits to want to do that through their approval process.
Well, you just said that a for-profit really doesn't have any real incentive to do that. So what do you think is enough to kind of swing them into your way of thinking or to meet the need of so many people?
Well, I think to ask them not to do an overwhelming amount, but a percentage of what they build and to make them incentivize them rather to perhaps through a quicker approval process or something of that nature or some increased density to keep a percentage of those units affordable for a longer period of time, transfer them to a nonprofit owner at the end of the city's requirement so that they could be carried forward from there and be well managed and continue to serve people who need them.
One of the areas that has drawn a lot of fire, as I'm sure you know, over the last couple of years is Kaka'ako, because we're looking at, you talk about density and building into the core, and yet many of the buildings going up there are luxury buildings.
That's right. Exactly. And it's really a tragedy because the need is not for luxury. Honolulu and the islands are a internationally driven high-cost housing market in a predominantly low-wage economy.
So how do you create that mixed community by bringing some of these in a place where already it looks as if it's been targeted for this, despite all the conversation about workforce housing in the same area?
You have to bake it into the cake of your approval process before your developers have already spent millions of dollars halfway through the approval process. And it really wasn't well enough thought out ahead of time, despite good intentions. So it's really very unfortunate. But I think with forthcoming transit-oriented development, there are more opportunities for developments like that that can include a percentage of affordability and also a percentage of housing first units for people who now are homeless. And we've done that very successfully in many of our developments where we just have a sprinkling of units for people who were homeless before they moved in, and we provide a lot of services to help them succeed. It's been very, very successful.
In helping people to sort of normalize their mm-hmm. own views of themselves and the world in which they live.
Right.
But for areas like Kaka'ako and others that you've seen, is there any way that you see, because you say you've got to bake it into the cake of what the plan would be, and we've been talking about the plan for Kaka'ako for such a long time. As you know it right now, do you see that there is any hope to have this done in this area, or we really have to look outside into other, transit-oriented development areas?
Only if the HCDA is willing to reconsider the 140% median definition of affordability and to specifically set aside land for affordable housing, will it happen.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time to talk. I'm glad to have been able to talk to you this morning. And good luck with the opening of the new development in Eva Beach.
Beautiful, beautiful property.
And for those 76 families who are going to get them, good luck to them, too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Mary Murtaugh realized that affordable housing was the cornerstone to many social justice issues when she started her career as an architect. She has been president and CEO of EAH Housing since 1986, and her nonprofit organization develops, manages, and advocates for affordable housing. Again, that new development will be opening in Eva Beach this weekend.
Support for today's programming comes from Ballet Hawaii, presenting Stars of American Ballet with principal dancers from the New York City Ballet, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday at Hawaii Theater, ballethawaii.org.
Earlier in the show, we asked if you knew the MTV program that was shot in Kaanapali in 2006. It was broadcast in early 2007, and during its run, it faced strong criticism for its editing, which made many believe that the reality show was, in fact, scripted. It also received backlash from local residents because of its perceived lack of racial and cultural diversity and its sexual content. Many residents also felt these factors brought with them misconceptions of Maui and of Hawaii in general. Nevertheless, the show was a success, and today we asked you to name it. Maybe you were one of the millions of viewers worldwide who watched Maui Fever. It's 8:47, and that is today's backyard quiz. If you have one, you can email it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Laurel Nakanishi, a MPI grad. You're tuned in to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
W.S. Merwin, American poet, believes in regeneration and lives his belief. For decades at his Maui home, he's worked to create a lush forest on land that had been all but destroyed, planting seedlings by hand, one by one. Today, his 19-acre forest on Maui's North Shore is home to one of the world's largest private collections of palm trees, and it now enjoys permanent conservation protection, thanks to a partnership between the Merwin Conservancy and the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust. We asked him how his poetry and his work to preserve a palm forest are connected.
There's no connection between something that was never separated. I mean,
yeah.
They belong together, and we are connected with every blade of grass and every insect in the universe. Only we like to pay attention to the traffic on the thruway instead, you know, and think that's the real world.
Well, and of course, in American literature, there's a long tradition of poetry that is closely connected to the natural world.
Oh, well, my hero is Thoreau.
Yes.
And Whitman off and on. Emily, dear Emily with her garden.
Well, exactly, but it just seems to make total sense. How did it originate, this project with the palm forest?
There was another element to it. I saw this piece of land, which was really like the outback in Australia. It was this valley, which had been absolutely wrecked by ruthless, first deforestation and then ruthless agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And including the final thing, a few guys who didn't know anything tried to make a pineapple plantation a part of the garden, and they plowed the whole place vertically. So that was the end of any topsoil up in the upper stretches. It's a valley.
They plowed it vertically so the topsoil just ran right off as soon as it rained.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when I came in, I saw the soil was just about as good as the dirt road, the track that I, plantation track I'd driven down on the ridge. I looked there and I thought, well, when I was in my 20s in London, I knew and read the people who were in the beginning of the soil movement in England,
mm-hmm.
and I was fascinated by them, and they were talking a lot about restoring ruined land, and I thought, if I ever got a piece of land that was badly treated, I'd like to see what I could do with it. So everybody said, you can't do anything in there. Well, I found that there's one kind of ironwood, as we call them now,
mm-hmm.
but actually they're casuarinas. It was, it's a wonderful name for them.
Yes.
By a 16th century Dutch botanist, because he said that their long sweeping boughs reminded him of the wings of the cassowary bird. So that was Rumphius, and everybody reveres Rumphius, including me.
Sure.
I found there are two species in particular that are among the only non-legumes that will actually put nitrogen and oxygen back into the soil and start building it up again.
Uh-huh.
And 30 years after I planted all of these all along the top of the ridge, it was a windbreak immediately. It changed the temperature immediately. It changed the moisture immediately. And they grow very fast. They grow to about 85 feet. And I had to cut them down 30 years later because they got termites. And well, I was planting other things. I planted palms around them. And I just out of curiosity took my planting spade and set it in the ground a foot away from the stump of the tree, pushed it, and it sank into 18 inches of black topsoil. And I thought, it's true what they say about these are great trees.
Sign of hope, right?
Yeah. Once you get it alive, once you get the soil alive again,
mm-hmm.
it spreads by itself. It wants to keep growing. And it's, so now we, Chipper Wickman of the National Tropical Botanical Garden was there recently. He said, oh, but you've got such wonderful soil. I said, no, I don't. It's got no NPK in it at all, and the humus is entirely made by the trees themselves. But once it gets started, it moved down the slope, so it looks as though it's all good now.
I have to think there are some larger lessons in all that.
These things are all connected.
Sure.
The life of the place. Once you start putting it back, it wants to be there. But the only native species, I tried to plant entirely native species. It didn't work. I mean, even koas. I mean, Paula, my wife and I planted 300 koas, and some of them would get up to 25, there were a few of them were absolutely beautiful. But they all got attacked by weevils that weren't there in the old days, or by one thing or another, and none of them survived. Except for one species that came from the Big Island, and so we keep them. But the other thing that grew here and managed with all the weird conditions was the first Hawaiian palm that I put in. And I thought, the palm, well, they're pretty tough. They'll live it out here. Palms are 90 million years old, and they've been in all sorts of places. So I thought, I'll grow some more palms. I got some more Hawaiian palms, and they were hard to get then. So I thought, but, we can't be too precious about this. Palms are endangered all over the world, just as Hawaiian natural world is. So I want to see what palms will grow here, because some of them must be endangered in their own habitat. And they were. It turns out that this garden apparently saved one species from extinction. They got an officially extinct seed from an officially extinct tree on Reunion Island. And a wonderful seed distributor sent it to me. And apparently I was the only person who grew them.
But, I have to think, William, that this is a story that could be replicated many times over in different places.
It certainly could be.
Where there is sufficient will.
Yeah, but you know, if you're trying to develop it all and turn it into something else, you don't want it to be something else. You want it to be itself.
Yeah. Again and again, I come back to lessons that inform your poetry and things that are found, insights that are found in your poetry.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad to see that.
W.S. Merwin is a former United States Poet Laureate who's been awarded the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award in a career that spans more than six decades. He's the keeper of the 19-acre Merwin Palm Collection near Haiku, Hawaii, which has been given permanent conservation protection through a partnership with the Merwin Conservancy, Copper Canyon Press, and the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust. You can learn more at hpr2.org.
This week on Applause in a Small Room, we take you to the Kahilu Theater for a concert featuring the talents of Hawaii Island artist Ekolu Meanui, performance poet Michelle Dalton, and country duo Willie Joe Kamara and Damian DeMello. Join us for an audio holiday at Waimea's Kahilu Theater for Applause from the Kahilu, this Sunday at 4 on HPR2.
So I've got to ask you, have you played the Candidates game
yet? I have
yet?
Not played it yet, but I am dying to, because I thought that was a very intriguing take on how people decide whom to vote for.
Well, because people care about issues. Sometimes they don't know exactly how they care about them or what they care about until you read it and you're confronted with it.
Yeah.
And as Olin Lagon was saying earlier, that the questions ask as much of us as they do of the candidates and their responses and how they sync with, you know, how you get your answers from yourself, that can tell you that maybe you have some different positions than perhaps you thought you had.
You select your issue, issue by issue, and then you find out who you should be voting for.
And you may get a surprise. Anyway, we've uploaded it to our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. So if you want to play, it's about 15 minutes, and you may find you get some real answers there, too. And as we know, it's a matter of not just focusing on the voter turnout issue, but getting people to care.
Exactly.
That's the show for today. On tomorrow's agenda, we'll talk to gubernatorial candidate Jeff Davis talking about caring.
And we'll get a preview of the Kamauela Philharmonic season opener.
We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you later today for Town Square with Mufi Henneman. And we'll be back tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.